think you picked up on my feelings for Ken before I did, when you were back at Argus. Ken and I have been more or less together for the last 2 months. Do you have some reservations?
Oh, no, Ellie, I am not your father or jealous lover. I wish only great happiness for you. It's just that I see so many unpleasant possibilities.
But he did not further elaborate. They returned to their preliminary interpretations of some of the diagrams, with which the table was eventually covered. For counterpoint, they also discussed a little politics, the debate in America over the Mandela principles for resolving the crisis in South Africa, and the growing war of words between the Soviet Union and the German Democratic Republic. As always, Arroway and Lunacharsky enjoyed denouncing their own country's foreign policies to one another. This was far more interesting than denouncing the foreign policies of each other's nation, which would have been equally easy to do. Over their ritual dispute about whether the check should be shared, she noticed that the downpour had diminished to a discreet drizzle. By now the news of the message from Vega had reached every nook and cranny of the planet Earth. People who knew nothing of radio telescopes and had never heard of a prime number had been told a peculiar story about a voice from the stars, about strange beings, not exactly men, but not exactly gods either, who had been discovered living in the night sky. They did not come from Earth. Their home star could easily be seen, even with a full moon. Amidst the continuing frenzy of sectarian commentary, there was also, all over the world, it was now apparent, a sense of wonder, even of awe, something transforming, something almost miraculous was happening. The air was full of possibility, a sense of new beginning. "Mankind has been promoted to high school," an American newspaper editorialist had written. There were other intelligent beings in the universe. We could communicate with them. They were probably older than we, possibly wiser. They were sending us libraries of complex information. There was a widespread anticipation of imminent secular revelation. So the specialists in every subject began to worry. Mathematicians worried about what elementary discoveries they might have missed. Religious leaders worried that vegan values, however alien, would find ready adherence, especially among the uninstructed young. Astronomers worried that there might be fundamentals about the nearby stars that they had gotten wrong. Politicians and government leaders worried that some other systems of government, some quite different from those currently fashionable, might be admired by a superior civilization. Whatever Vegans knew had not been influenced by peculiarly human institutions, history, or biology. What if much that we think true is a misunderstanding, a special case or a logical blunder? Experts uneasily began to reassess the foundations of their subjects. Beyond this narrow vocational disquiet was a great and soaring perception of a new adventure for the human species, of turning a corner, of bursting into a new age. A symbolism powerfully amplified by the approach of the third millennium. There were still political conflicts, some of them, like the continuing South African crisis, serious. But there was also a notable decline in many quarters of the world of jingoist rhetoric and puerile self-congratulatory nationalism. There was a sense of the human species, billions of tiny beings spread over the world, collectively presented with an unprecedented opportunity, or even a grave common danger. To many it seemed absurd for the contending nation-states to continue their deadly quarrels when faced with a non-human civilization of vastly greater capabilities. There was a whiff of hope in the air. Some people were unaccustomed to it, and mistook it for something else, confusion, perhaps, or cowardice. For decades after 1945, the world stockpile of strategic nuclear weapons had steadily grown. Leaders changed, weapons systems changed, strategy changed. But the number of strategic weapons only increased. The time came when there were more than 25,000 of them on the planet, 10 for every city. The technology was pushing towards short flight time, incentives for hard target first strike, and at least de facto launch on warning. Only so monumental a danger could undo so monumental a foolishness. Endorsed by so many leaders and so many nations for so long a time. But finally the world came to its senses, at least to this extent, and an accord was signed by the United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, France, and China. It was not intended to rid the world of nuclear weapons. Few expected it to carry some utopia in its wake. But the Americans and the Russians undertook to diminish their strategic arsenals down to 1,000 nuclear weapons each. The details were carefully designed so that neither superpower was at any significant disadvantage at any stage of the dismantling process. Britain, France, and China agreed to begin reducing their arsenals once the superpowers had gone below the 3,200 mark. The Hiroshima Accords were signed, to worldwide rejoicing, next to the famous commemorative plaque for the victims in the first city ever obliterated by a nuclear weapon. Rest in peace, for it shall never happen again. Every day the fission triggers from an equal number of U.S. and Soviet warheads were delivered to a special facility run by American and Russian technicians. The plutonium was extracted, logged, sealed, and transported by bilateral teams to nuclear power plants, where it was consumed and converted into electricity. This scheme, known as the Gaylor Plan, after an American admiral, was widely hailed as the ultimate in beating swords into plowshares. Since each nation still retained a devastating retaliatory capability, even the military establishments eventually welcomed it. Generals no more wish for their children to die than anyone else, and nuclear war is the negation of the conventional military virtues. It is hard to find much valor in pressing a button. The first divestment ceremony, televised live and rebroadcast many times, featured white-clad American and Soviet technicians wheeling in two of the dull gray metallic objects, each about as big as an ottoman, and festooned variously with stars and stripes, hammers and sickles. It was witnessed by a huge fraction of the world population. The evening television news programs regularly counted how many strategic weapons on both sides had been disassembled, how many more to go. In a little over two decades, this news too would reach Vega. In the following years, the divestitures continued, almost without a hitch. At first, the fat in the arsenals was surrendered, with little change in strategic doctrine. But now the cuts were being felt, and the most destabilizing weapon systems were being dismantled. It was something the experts had called impossible and declared contrary to human nature. But a sentence of death, as Samuel Johnson had noted, concentrates the mind wonderfully. In the past half year, the dismantling of nuclear weapons by the United States and the Soviet Union had made major new strides, with fairly intrusive inspection teams of each nation soon to be installed on the territory of the other, despite the disapproval and concern publicly voiced by the military staffs of both nations. The United Nations found itself unexpectedly effective in mediating international disputes, with the West Iran and the Chile-Argentina border wars both apparently resolved. There was even talk, not all of it fatuous, of a non-aggression treaty between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. The delegates arriving in the first plenary session of the World Message Consortium were predisposed toward cordiality to an extent unparalleled in recent decades. Every nation, with even a handful of message bits, was represented, sending both scientific and political delegates. A surprising number sent military representatives as well. In a few cases, national delegations were led by foreign ministers or even heads of state. The United Kingdom delegation included Viscount Boxforth, the Lord Privy Seal, an honorific Ellie privately found hilarious. The USSR delegation was headed by B. Ya Abukimov, president of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, with Godzrichev, the minister of medium-heavy industry, and Arkhangelsky playing significant roles. The president of the United States had insisted that Trahir head the American delegation, although it included Undersecretary of State Elmo Honeycutt and Michael Kitts, among others, for the Department of Defense. A vast and elaborate map in equal area projection showed the disposition of radio telescopes over the planet, including the Soviet ocean-going tracking vessels. Ellie glanced around the newly completed conference hall, adjacent to the offices and residence of the President of France. In only the second year of his 7-year term, he was making every effort to guarantee the meeting's success. A multitude of faces, flags, and national dress was reflected off the long, arcing mahogany tables and the mirrored walls. She recognized few of the political and military people, but in every delegation, there seemed to be at least one familiar scientist or engineer. Annunziata and Ian Broderick from Australia. Fedirka from Czechoslovakia. Brod, Crepillon, and Boileau from France. Kumar Chandrapurana and Devi Sukhavati from India. Hiranaga and Matsui from Japan. Ellie reflected on the strong technological, rather than radio-astronomical background of many of the delegates, especially the Japanese. The idea that the construction of some vast machine might be on the agenda of this meeting had motivated last-minute changes in the composition of delegates. She also recognized Malatesta of Italy, Biedenbaugh, a physicist fallen into politics, Clegg, and the venerable Sir Arthur Chaitos, chatting behind the sort of Union Jack one can find on restaurant tables in European resorts. Jaime Ortiz of Spain. Prebula from Switzerland, which was puzzling since Switzerland did not, so far as she knew, even have a radio telescope. Bao, who had done brilliantly in putting together the Chinese radio telescope array. Wintergarden from Sweden. There were surprisingly large Saudi, Pakistani, and Iraqi delegations. And, of course, the Soviets, among whom Nadia Rozhdestvenskaya and Genrikh Arkhangelsky were sharing a moment of genuine hilarity. Ellie looked for Lunacharsky and finally spotted him with the Chinese delegation. He was shaking hands with Yu Renquang, the director of the Beijing Radio Observatory. She recalled that the two men had been friends and colleagues during the period of Sino-Soviet cooperation, but the hostilities between their two nations had ended all contact between them, and Chinese restrictions on foreign travel by their senior scientists were still almost as severe as Soviet constraints. She was witnessing, she realized, their first meeting in perhaps a quarter century.
"Who's the old China person Vege's shaking hands with?"
This was for Kitts an attempt at cordiality. He had been making small offerings of this sort for the last few days, a development she regarded as unpromising.
You, director of the Beijing Observatory.
Oh, I thought those guys hated each other's guts.
Michael, she said, the world is both better and worse than you imagine.
You can probably beat me on better, he replied. But you can't hold a candle to me on worse.
After the welcome by the President of France, who, to mild astonishment, stayed to hear the opening presentations, and a discussion of procedure and agenda by Trahir and Abukimov as conference co-chairman, Ellie and Vege together summarized the data. They made what were by now standard presentations, not too technical because of the political and military people, of how radio telescopes work, the distribution of nearby stars in space, and the history of the palimpsest message. Their tandem presentation concluded with a survey, displayed on the monitors before each delegation, of the diagrammatic material recently received. She was careful to show how the polarization modulation was converted into a sequence of zeros and ones,
how the zeros and ones fit together to make a picture, and how in most cases they had not the vaguest notion of what the picture conveyed. The data points reassembled themselves on the computer screens. She could see faces illuminated in white, amber, and green by the monitors in the now partly darkened hall. The diagrams showed intricate branching networks, lumpy, almost indecently biological forms, a perfectly formed, regular dodecahedron. A long series of pages had been reassembled into an elaborately detailed three-dimensional construction which slowly rotated. Each enigmatic object was joined by an unintelligible caption. Vege stressed the uncertainties still more strongly than she did. Nevertheless, it was, in his opinion, now beyond doubt that the message was a handbook for the construction of a machine. He neglected to mention that the idea of the message as a blueprint had originally been his and Arkhangelsky's, and Ellie seized the opportunity to rectify the oversight. She had talked about the subject enough over the past few months to know that both scientific and general audiences were often fascinated by the details of the unraveling of the message and tantalized by the still unproved concept of a primer. But she was unprepared for the response from this, one would expect, staid audience. Vege and she had interdigitated their presentations. As they finished, there was a sustained thunder of applause. The Soviets and Eastern European delegations applauded in unison, with a frequency of about 2 or 3 hand claps per heartbeat. The Americans and many others applauded separately, their unsynchronized clapping a sea of white noise rising from the crowd. Enveloped by an unfamiliar kind of joy, she could not resist thinking about the differences in national character, the Americans as individualists, and the Russians engaged in a collective endeavor. Also, she recalled that Americans in crowds tried to maximize their distance from their fellows, while Soviets tended to lean on each other as much as possible. Both styles of applause, the American clearly dominant, delighted her. For just a moment, she permitted herself to think about her stepfather and her father. After lunch, there was a succession of other presentations on the data collection and interpretation. David Drumlin gave an extraordinarily capable discussion of a statistical analysis he had recently performed of all previous pages of the message that referred to the new numbered diagrams. He argued that the message contained not just a blueprint for building a machine, but also descriptions of the designs and means of fabrication of components and subcomponents. In a few cases, he thought, there were descriptions of whole new industries not yet known on Earth. Ellie, mouth agape, shook her finger toward Drumlin, silently asking Valerian whether he had known about this. His lips pursed. Valerian hunched his shoulders and rotated his hands, palms up. She scanned the other delegates for some expression of emotion, but could detect mainly signs of fatigue, the depth of technical material, and the necessity sooner or later of making political decisions were already producing strain. After the session, she complimented Drumlin on the interpretation, but asked why she had not heard of it until now. He replied before walking away.
"Oh, I didn't think it was important enough to bother you with. It was just a little something I did while you were out consulting religious fanatics."
If Drumlin had been her thesis advisor, she would still be pursuing her PhD, she thought. He had never fully accepted her. They would never share an easygoing, collegial relationship. Sighing, she wondered whether Ken had known about Drumlin's new work. But as conference co-chairman, Drahir was sitting with his Soviet opposite number on a raised dais facing the horseshoe of delegate tiers. He was, as he had been for weeks, nearly inaccessible. Drumlin was not obliged to discuss his findings with her, of course. She knew they both had been preoccupied recently. But in conversation with him, why was she always accommodating and argumentative only in extremis? A part of her evidently felt that the granting of her doctorate and the opportunity to pursue her science
were still future possibilities, firmly in Drumlin's hands. On the morning of the second day, a Soviet delegate was given the floor. He was unknown to her. Stefan Alexievich Baruda, the vitagraphics on her computer screen read out. Director, Institute for Peace Studies, Soviet Academy of Sciences, Moscow. Member, Central Committee, Communist Party of the USSR. "Now we start to play hardball," she heard Michael Kitt say to Elmo Honeycutt of the State Department. Baruda was a dapper man, wearing an elegantly tailored and impeccably fashionable Western business suit, perhaps of Italian cut. His English was fluent and almost unaccented. He had been born in one of the Baltic republics, was young to be head of such an important organization, formed to study the long-term implications for strategic policy of the deaccessioning of nuclear weapons, and was a leading example of the new wave in the Soviet leadership. "Let us be frank," Baruda was saying. "A message is being sent to us from the far reaches of space. Most of the information has been gathered by the Soviet Union and the United States. Essential pieces have also been obtained by other countries. All of those countries are represented at this conference. Any one nation, the Soviet Union, for example, could have waited until the message repeated itself several times, as we all hope it will, and fill in the many missing pieces in such a way. But it will take years, perhaps decades, and we are a little impatient. So we have all shared the data. Any one nation, the Soviet Union, for example, could place into orbit around the Earth large radio telescopes with sensitive receivers that work at the frequencies of the message. The Americans could do this as well. Perhaps Japan or France or the European Space Agency could. Then any one nation by itself could acquire all the data. Because in space, a radio telescope can point at Vega all the time. But that might be thought a hostile act. It is no secret that the United States or the Soviet Union might be able to shoot down such satellites. So perhaps for this reason, too, we have all shared the data. It is better to cooperate. Our scientists wish to exchange not only the data they have gathered, but also their speculations, their guesses, their dreams. All you scientists are alike in that respect. I am not a scientist. My specialty is government. So I know that the nations are also alike. Every nation is cautious. Every nation is suspicious. None of us would give an advantage to a potential adversary if we could prevent it. And so there have been two opinions. Well, perhaps more, but at least two. One that counsels exchange of all the data, and another that counsels each nation to seek advantage over the others. You can be sure the other side is seeking some advantage, they say. It is the same in most countries. The scientists have won this debate. So, for example, most of the data, although I wish to point out not all, acquired by the United States and the Soviet Union, have been exchanged. Most of the data from all other countries have been exchanged worldwide. We are happy we have made this decision. Ellie whispered to Kitts, "This doesn't sound like hardball to me." "Stay tuned," he whispered back. "But there are other kinds of dangers. We would like now to raise one of them for the consortium to consider." Baruda's tone reminded her of Vega's at lunch the other day. What was the bee in the Soviet bonnet? "We have heard academician Lunacharsky, Dr. Arroway, and other scientists agree that we are receiving the instructions for building a complex machine. Suppose that, as everyone seems to expect, the end of the message comes. The message recycles to the beginning, and we receive the introduction or, the English word is primer? Primer, which lets us read the message. Suppose also that we continue to cooperate fully, all of us. We exchange all the data, all the fantasies, all the dreams. Now the beings on Vega, they are not sending us these instructions for their amusement. They want us to build a machine. Perhaps they will tell us what the machine is supposed to do, perhaps not. But even if they do, why should we believe them?
So I raise my own fantasy, my own dream. It is not a happy one. What if this machine is a Trojan horse? We build the machine at great expense. Turn it on and suddenly an invading army pours out of it. Or what if it is a doomsday machine? We build it, turn it on, and the earth blows up. Perhaps this is their way to suppress civilizations just emerging into the cosmos. It would not cost much. They pay only for a telegram. And the upstart civilization obediently destroys itself. What I am about to ask is only a suggestion, a talking point. I raise it for your consideration. I mean it to be constructive. On this issue, we all share the same planet. We all have the same interests. No doubt I will put it too bluntly. Here is my question. Would it be better to burn the data and destroy the radio telescopes? A commotion ensued. Many delegations asked simultaneously to be recognized. Instead, the conference co-chairman seemed mainly motivated to remind the delegates that sessions were not to be recorded or videotaped. No interviews were to be granted to the press. There would be daily press releases agreed upon by the conference co-chairman and the leaders of delegations. Even the integuments of the present discussion were to remain in this conference chamber. Several delegates asked for clarification from the chair.
"If Baruda is right about a Trojan horse or a doomsday machine," shouted out a Dutch delegate, "isn't it our duty to inform the public?"
But he had not been recognized, and his microphone had not been activated. They went on to other, more urgent matters. Ellie had quickly punched into the institutional computer terminal before her for an early position in the queue. She discovered that she was scheduled second, after Sukhavati, and before one of the Chinese delegates. Ellie knew Devi Sukhavati slightly. A stately woman in her mid-40s, she was wearing a Western coiffure, high-heeled sling-back pumps, and an exquisite silk sari. Originally trained as a physician, she had become one of the leading Indian experts in molecular biology, and now shared her time between King's College, Cambridge, and the Tata Institute in Bombay. She was one of a handful of Indian fellows of the Royal Society of London, and was said to be well-placed politically. They had last met a few years before at an international symposium in Tokyo, before receipt of the message had eliminated the obligatory question marks in the titles of some of their scientific papers. Ellie had sensed a mutual affinity, due only in part to the fact that they were among the few women participating in scientific meetings on extraterrestrial life.
"I recognize that academician Baruda has raised an important and sensitive issue," Sukhavati began, "and it would be foolish to dismiss the Trojan horse possibility carelessly. Given most of recent history, this is a natural idea, and I'm surprised it took so long to be raised. However, I would like to caution against such fears. It is unlikely in the extreme that the beings on a planet of the star Vega are exactly at our level of technological advance. Even on our planet, cultures do not evolve in lockstep. Some start earlier, others later. I recognize that some cultures can catch up at least technologically. When there were high civilizations in India, China, Iraq, and Egypt, there were, at best, Iron Age nomads in Europe and Russia, and Stone Age cultures in America. But the differences in the technologies will be much greater in the present circumstances. The extraterrestrials are likely to be far ahead of us. Certainly more than a few hundred years further along, perhaps thousands of years ahead of us, or even millions. Now I ask you to compare that with the pace of human technological advancement in the last century. I grew up in a tiny village in South India. In my grandmother's time, the treadle sewing machine was a technological wonder. What would beings who are thousands of years ahead of us be capable of? Or millions? As a philosopher in our part of the world once said, the artifacts of a sufficiently advanced extraterrestrial civilization would be indistinguishable from magic. We can pose no threat to them whatever. They have nothing to fear from us, and that will be true for a very long time.
This is no confrontation between Greeks and Trojans who are evenly matched. This is no science fiction movie where beings from different planets fight with similar weapons. If they wish to destroy us, they can certainly do so with or without our
But at what cost?
Someone interrupted from the floor.
Don't you see? That's the point. Baruda is saying our television broadcasts to space are there notice that it's time to destroy us. And the message is the means. Punitive expeditions are dear. The message is cheap.
Ellie could not make out who had shouted out this intervention. It seemed to be someone in the British delegation. His remarks had not been amplified by the audio system, because again the speaker had not been recognized by the chair. But the acoustics in the conference hall were sufficiently good that he could be heard perfectly well. Drahir, in the chair, tried to keep order. Abukimov leaned over and whispered something to an aide.
"You think there is a danger in building the machine?"
Sukhavati replied.
"I think there is a danger in not building the machine. I would be ashamed of our planet if we turned our back on the future. Your ancestors."
She shook a finger at her interlocutor.
"Were not so timid when they first set sail for India or America."
This meeting was getting to be full of surprises, Ellie thought, although she doubted whether Clive or Raleigh were the best role models for present decision-making. Perhaps Sukhavati was only tweaking the British for past colonial offences. She waited for the green speaker's light on her console to illuminate, indicating that her microphone was activated.
"Mr. Chairman,"
she found herself in this formal and public posture addressing Drahir, whom she had hardly seen in the last few days. They had arranged to spend tomorrow afternoon together during a break in the meeting, and she felt some anxiety about what they would say. Oops. Wrong thought, she thought.
Mr. Chairman, I believe we can shed some light on these two questions, the Trojan horse and the doomsday machine. I had intended to discuss this tomorrow morning, but it certainly seems relevant now.
On her console, she punched in the code numbers for a few of her slides. The great mirrored hall darkened. Dr. Lunacharsky and I are convinced that these are different projections of the same three-dimensional configuration. We showed the entire configuration in computer-simulated rotation yesterday. We think, though we can't be sure, that this is what the interior of the machine will look like. There is as yet no clear indication of scale. Maybe it's a kilometer across. Maybe it's sub-microscopic. But notice these five objects evenly spaced around the periphery of the main interior chamber, inside the dodecahedron. Here's a close-up of one of them. They're the only things in the chamber that look at all recognizable. This appears to be an ordinary overstuffed armchair, perfectly configured for a human being. It's very unlikely that extraterrestrial beings evolved on another quite different world would resemble us sufficiently to share our preferences in living room furniture. Here, look at this close-up. It looks like something from my mother's spare room when I was growing up. Indeed, it almost seemed to have flowered slipcovers. A small flutter of guilt entered her mind. She had neglected to call her mother before leaving for Europe, and if truth be told, had called her only once or twice since the message was received. "Ellie, how could you?" she remonstrated with herself. She looked again at the computer graphics. The five-fold symmetry of the dodecahedron was reflected in the five interior chairs, each facing a pentagonal surface.
"So it's our contention, Dr. Lunacharsky and I, that the five chairs are meant for us, for people. That would mean that the interior chamber of the machine is only a few meters across, the exterior perhaps 10 or 20 meters across. The technology is undoubtedly formidable, but we don't think we're talking about building something the size of a city, or as complex as an aircraft carrier. We might very well be able to build this, whatever it is, if we all work together. What I'm trying to say is that you don't put chairs inside a bomb. I don't think this is a doomsday machine, or a Trojan horse.
I agree with what Dr. Sukhavati said, or maybe only implied. The idea that this is a Trojan horse is itself an indication of how far we have to go. Again, there was an outburst. But this time, Derheer made no effort to stop it. Indeed, he actually turned the complainant's microphone on. It was the same delegate who had interrupted Sukhavati a few minutes earlier. Philip Biedenbaugh of the United Kingdom, a Labour Party minister in the shaky coalition government.
"Simply doesn't understand what our concern is. If it was literally a wooden horse, we would not be tempted to bring the alien device within the city gates. We have read our Homer, but flounce it up with some upholstery, and our suspicions are allayed. Why? Because we are being flattered or bribed. There's an historic adventure implied. There's the promise of new technologies. There's a hint of acceptance by, how to put it, greater beings. But I say, no matter what lofty fantasies the radio astronomers may entertain, if there is even a tiny chance the machine is a means of destruction, it should not be built. Better, as the Soviet delegate has proposed, to burn the data tapes and make the construction of radio telescopes a capital crime. The meeting was becoming unruly. Scores of delegates were electronically queuing for authorization to speak. The hubbub rose to a subdued roar that reminded Ellie of her years of listening to radio astronomical static. A consensus did not seem readily within reach, and the co-chairmen were clearly unable to restrain the delegates. As the Chinese delegate rose to speak, the vitagraphics were slow to appear on Ellie's screen, and she looked around for help. She had no idea who this man was either. Nien Bobby Bui, a National Security Council staffer, now assigned to Derheer, leaned over and said, "Shi Kemu's his name. Spelled X-I. Pronounced Shi. Heavy dude. Born on the Long March. Volunteer as a teenager in Korea. Government official, mainly political. Knocked down for a 9-count in the Cultural Revolution. Central Committee member now. Very influential. Been in the news lately. Also directs Chinese archaeological digging." Shi Kuamyu was a tall, broad-shouldered man around 60. The wrinkles on his face made him seem older, but his posture and physique gave him an almost youthful appearance. He wore his tunic buttoned at the collar in the fashion that was as obligatory for Chinese political leaders as three-piece suits were for American governmental leaders, the president, of course, excepted. The vitagraphics now came through on her console, and she could remember having read a long article about Shi Kuamyu in one of the video news magazines.
"If we are frightened," he was saying, "we will do nothing. That will delay them a little. But remember, they know we are here. Our television arrives at their planet. Every day they are reminded of us. Have you looked at our television programs? They will not forget us. If we do nothing, and if they are worried about us, they will come to us, machine or no machine. We cannot hide from them. If we had kept quiet, we would not face this problem. If we had cable television only, and no big military radar, then maybe they would not know about us. But now it is too late. We cannot go back. Our course is set. If you are seriously frightened about this machine destroying the Earth, do not build it on the Earth. Build it somewhere else. Then, if it is a doomsday machine and blows up a world, it will not be our world. But this will be very expensive, probably too expensive. Or if we are not so frightened, build it in some isolated desert. You could have a very big explosion in the Tokopi Wasteland in Xinjiang Province and still kill nobody. And if we are not frightened at all, we can build it in Washington, or Moscow, or Beijing, or in this beautiful city. In ancient China, Vega and two nearby stars were called Qianyu. It means the young woman with the spinning wheel. It is an auspicious symbol, a machine to make new clothes for the people of the Earth. We have received an invitation, a very unusual invitation. Maybe it is to go to a banquet.
The Earth has never been invited to a banquet before. It would be impolite to refuse.
Chapter 12. The One Delta Isomer. Looking at the stars always makes me dream, as simply as I dream over the black dots representing towns and villages on a map. Why, I ask myself, shouldn't the shining dots of the sky be as accessible as the black dots on the map of France? Vincent van Gogh. It was a splendid autumn afternoon, so unseasonably warm that Devi Sukhavati had left her coat behind. She and Ellie walked along the crowded Champs-Élysées toward the Place de la Concorde. The ethnic diversity was rivaled by London, Manhattan, and only a few other cities on the planet. Two women walking together, one in a skirt and sweater, the other in a sari, were in no way unusual. Outside a tobacconist's, there was a long, orderly, and polyglot line of people attracted by the first week of legalized sale of cured cannabis cigarettes from the United States. By French law, they could not be sold to or consumed by those under 18 years of age. Many in line were middle-aged and older. Some might have been naturalized Algerians or Moroccans. Especially potent varieties of cannabis were grown, mainly in California and Oregon, for the export trade. Featured here was a new and admired strain, which had, in addition, been grown in ultraviolet light, converting some of the inert cannabinoids into the One Delta isomer. It was called Sunkissed. The package, illustrated in a window display a meter and a half high, bore in French the slogan, "This will be deducted from your share in paradise." The shop windows along the boulevard were a riot of color. The two women bought chestnuts from a street vendor and reveled in the taste and texture. For some reason, every time Ellie saw a sign advertising BNP, the Banque Nationale de Paris, she read it as the Russian word for beer, with the middle letter inverted left to right. Beer. The signs, lately corrupted from their usual and respectable fiduciary vocations, seemed to be exhorting her. Russian beer. The incongruity amused her, and only with difficulty could she convince the part of her brain in charge of reading that this was the Latin, not the Cyrillic alphabet. Further on, they marveled at l'obélisque, an ancient military commemorative, stolen at great expense to become a modern military commemorative. They decided to walk on. Durhir had broken the date. Or at least that's what it amounted to. He had called her up this morning, apologetic but not desperately so. There were too many political issues being raised at the plenary session. The Secretary of State was flying in tomorrow, interrupting a visit to Cuba. Durhir's hands were full and he hoped Ellie would understand. She understood. She hated herself for sleeping with him. To avoid an afternoon alone, she had dialed Devi Sukhavati. One of the Sanskrit words for victorious is Abhijit. That's what Vega was called in ancient India, Abhijit. It was under the influence of Vega that the Hindu divinities, our culture heroes, conquered the Asuras, the gods of evil. Ellie, are you listening? Now, it's a curious thing. In Persia there are Asuras also, but in Persia, the Asuras were the gods of good. Eventually, religion sprang up in which the chief god, the god of light, the sun god, was called Ahura Mazda. The Zoroastrians, for example, and the Mithraists. Ahura, Asura, it's the same name. There are still Zoroastrians today, and the Mithraists gave the early Christians a good fright. But in the same story, those Hindu divinities, they were mainly female, by the way, were called Devis. Where's the origin of my own name? In India, the Devis are gods of good. In Persia, the Devis become gods of evil. Some scholars think this is where the English word devil ultimately comes from. The symmetry is complete. All this is probably some vaguely remembered account of the Aryan invasion that pushed the Davidians
my ancestors, to the south. So depending on which side of the Kirtar range one lives on, Vega supports either God or the devil. This cheerful story had been proffered as a gift by Devi, who clearly had heard something of Ellie's California religious adventures 2 weeks before. Ellie was grateful. But it reminded her that she had not even mentioned to Joss the possibility that the message was the blueprint for a machine of unknown purpose. Now he would soon enough be hearing all this through the media. She should really, she told herself sternly, make an overseas call to explain to him the new developments. But Joss was said to be in seclusion. He had offered no public statement following their meeting in Modesto. Rankin, in a press conference, announced that while there might be some dangers, he was not opposed to letting the scientists receive the full message. But translation was another matter. Periodic review by all segments of society was required, he said, especially by those entrusted to safeguard spiritual and moral values. They were now approaching the Tuileries Gardens, where the garish hues of autumn were on display. Frail and elderly men, Ellie judged them to be from Southeast Asia, were in vigorous dispute. Ornamenting the black cast-iron gates were multicolored balloons on sale. At the center of a pool of water was a marble amphitrite. Around her, toy sailboats were racing, urged on by an exuberant crowd of small children with Magellanic aspirations. A catfish suddenly broke water, swamping the lead boat, and the boys and girls became subdued, chastened by this wholly unexpected apparition. The sun was low in the west, and Ellie felt a momentary chill. They approached L'Orangerie, in the annex of which was a special exhibition, so the poster proclaimed, Image Martienne. The joint American-French-Soviet robot roving vehicles on Mars had produced a spectacular windfall of color photographs. Some, like the Voyager images of the outer solar system around 1980, soaring beyond their mere scientific purpose and becoming art. The poster featured a landscape photographed on the vast Elysium Plateau. In the foreground was a three-sided pyramid, smooth, highly eroded, with an impact crater near the base. It had been produced by millions of years of high-speed sandblasting by the fierce Martian winds, the planetary geologists had said. A second rover, assigned to Cydonia on the other side of Mars, had become mired in a drifting dune, and its controllers in Pasadena had been so far unable to respond to its forlorn cries for help. Ellie found herself riveted on Sukhavati's appearance, her huge black eyes, erect bearing, and yet another magnificent sari. She thought to herself, I'm not graceful. Usually she found herself able to continue her part of a conversation while mentally addressing other matters as well. But today she had trouble following one line of thought, never mind two. While they were discussing the merits of the several opinions on whether to build the machine, in her mind's eye she returned to Davy's image from the Aryan invasion of India 3,500 years ago. A war between two peoples, each of whom claimed victory, each of whom patriotically exaggerated the historical accounts. Ultimately, the story is transformed into a war of the gods. Our side, of course, is good. The other side, of course, is evil. She imagined the goateed, spade-tailed, cloven-hoofed devil of the West evolving by slow evolutionary steps over thousands of years from some Hindu antecedent who, for all Ellie knew, had the head of an elephant and was painted blue. Baruda's Trojan horse. Maybe it's not a completely foolish idea, she found herself saying. But I don't see that we have any choice, as she said. They can be here in 20-some-odd years if they want to. They arrived at a monumental arch, in the Roman style, surmounted by a heroic, indeed apotheotic statue of Napoleon as chariot driver. From the long view, from an extraterrestrial perspective, how pathetic this posturing was. They rested on a nearby bench,
their long shadows cast over a bed of flowers planted in the colors of the French Republic. Ellie longed to discuss her own emotional predicament, but that might have political overtones. It would at the very least be indiscreet. She did not know Sukhavati very well. Instead, she encouraged her companion to speak about her personal life. Sukhavati acquiesced readily enough. She had been born to a Brahmin but unprosperous family with matriarchal proclivities in the southern state of Tamil Nadu. Matriarchal households were still common all over South India. She matriculated at Banaras Hindu University. At medical school in England, she had met and fallen deeply in love with Surinder Ghosh, a fellow medical student. But Surinder was a Harijan, an untouchable, of a caste so loathed that the mere sight of them was held by orthodox Brahmins to be polluting. Surinder's ancestors had been forced to live a nocturnal existence, like bats and owls. Her family threatened to disown her if they married. Her father declared that he had no daughter who would consider such a union. If she married Ghosh, he would mourn her as though she were dead. She married him anyway. "We were too much in love," she said. "I really had no choice." Within the year, he died from septicemia, acquired while performing an autopsy under inadequate supervision. Instead of reconciling her to her family, however, Surinder's death accomplished the opposite, and after receiving her medical degree, Devi decided to remain in England. She discovered a natural affinity for molecular biology and considered it an effortless continuation of her medical studies. She soon found she had real talent in this meticulous discipline. Knowledge of nucleic acid replication led her to work on the origin of life, and that in turn led her to consider life on other planets. "You could say that my scientific career has been a sequence of free associations. One thing just led to another." She had recently been working on the characterization of Martian organic matter, measured in a few locales on Mars, by the same roving vehicles whose stunning photographic products they had just seen advertised. Devi had never remarried, although she made it plain there were some who pursued her. Lately she had been seeing a scientist in Bombay, whom she described as a computerwala. Walking a little farther on, they found themselves in the Cœur Napoléon, the interior courtyard of the Louvre Museum. In its center was the newly completed and wildly controversial pyramidal entrance, and in high niches around the courtyard were sculptural representations of the heroes of French civilization. Captured under each statue of a revered man, they could see little evidence of revered women, was his surname. Occasionally, letters were eroded by natural weathering, or in a few cases perhaps effaced by some offended passerby. For one or two statues, it was difficult to piece together who the savant had been. On the statue that had evidently evoked the greatest public resentment, only the letters LTA remained. Although the sun was setting and the Louvre was open until mid-evening, they did not enter, but instead ambled along the Seine embankment, following the river back along the Quai d'Orsay. The proprietors of bookstalls were fastening shutters and closing up shop for the day. For a while they strolled on, arm in arm in the European manner. A French couple was walking a few paces ahead of them, each parent holding one hand of their daughter, a girl of about 4, who would periodically launch herself off the pavement. In her momentary suspension in 0G, she experienced, it was apparent, something akin to ecstasy. The parents were discussing the World Message Consortium, which was hardly a coincidence since the newspapers had been full of little else. The man was for building the machine. It might create new technologies and increase employment in France. The woman was more cautious, but for reasons she had difficulty articulating. The daughter, braids flying, was wholly unconcerned about what to do with a blueprint from the stars. Derheer, Kitts, and Honeycutt had called a meeting at the American Embassy early the following morning to prepare for the arrival of the Secretary of State later in the day. The meeting was to be classified and held in the embassy's black room, a chamber electromagnetically decoupled from the outside world, making even sophisticated electronic surveillance impossible. Or so it was claimed. Ellie thought there might be instrumentation developed that could make an end run around these precautions. After spending the afternoon with Devi Sukhavati, she had received the message at her hotel and had tried to call her here, but was able only to reach Michael Kitts. She opposed a classified meeting on this subject, she said. It was a matter of principle. The message was clearly intended for the entire planet. Kitts replied that there were no data being withheld from the rest of the world, at least by Americans, and that the meeting was merely advisory, to assist the United States in the difficult procedural negotiations ahead. He appealed to her patriotism, to her self-interest, and at last invoked again the Haddon decision. "For all I know, that thing is still sitting in your safe unread. Read it," he urged. She tried again unsuccessfully to reach Derheer. First, the man turns up everywhere in the Argus facility like a bad penny. He moves in with you in your apartment. You're sure, for the first time in years, you're in love. The next minute, you can't even get him to answer the phone. She decided to attend the meeting, if only to see Ken face to face. Kitts was enthusiastically for building the machine. Drumlin cautiously in favor. Derheer and Honeycutt at least outwardly uncommitted. And Peter Valerian in an agony of indecision. Kitts and Drumlin were even talking about where to build the thing. Freightage costs alone made manufacture or even assembly on the far side of the moon prohibitively expensive, as she had guessed. "If we use aerodynamic braking, it's cheaper to send a kilogram to Phobos or Deimos than to the far side of the moon," Bobby Bui volunteered. "Where the hell is Phobos or Deimos?" Kitts wanted to know. "The moon's of Mars. I was talking about aerodynamic braking in the Martian atmosphere." "And, how long does it take to get to Phobos or Deimos?" Drumlin was stirring his cup of coffee. "Maybe a year, but once we have a fleet of interplanetary transfer vehicles and the pipeline is full, compared with 3 days to the moon," sputtered Drumlin. "Bui, stop wasting our time." "It's only a suggestion," he protested. "You know, just something to think about." Derheer seemed impatient, distracted. He was clearly under great pressure, alternately avoiding her eyes and, she thought, making some unspoken appeal. She took it as a hopeful sign. "If you want to worry about doomsday machines," Drumlin was saying, "you have to worry about energy supplies. If it doesn't have access to an enormous amount of energy, it can't be a doomsday machine. So as long as the instructions don't ask for a gigawatt nuclear reactor, I don't think we have to worry about doomsday machines." "Why are you guys in such a hurry to commit to construction?" she asked Kitts and Drumlin collectively. They were sitting next to each other, with a plate of croissant between them. Kitts looked from Honeycutt to Derheer before answering. "This is a classified meeting," he began. "We all know you won't pass anything said here on to your Russian friends. It's like this. We don't know what the machine will do, but it's clear from Dave Drumlin's analysis that there's new technology in it, probably new industries. Constructing the machine is bound to have economic value. I mean, think of what we'd learn. And it might have military value. At least that's what the Russians are thinking. See, the Russians are in a box. Here's a whole new area of technology they're going to have to keep up with the U.S. on. Maybe there's instructions for some decisive weapon in the message or some economic advantage. They can't be sure. They'll have to bust their economy trying. Did you notice how Baruda kept referring to what was cost-effective? If all this message stuff went away, burn the data, destroy the telescopes, then the Russians could maintain military parity. That's why they're so cautious. So, of course, that's why we're gung-ho for it." He smiled. Temperamentally, Kitts was bloodless, she thought. But he was far from stupid. When he was cold and withdrawn, people tended not to like him. So he had developed an occasional veneer of urbane amiability. In Ellie's view, it was a molecular monolayer thick. "Now let me ask you a question," he continued. "Did you catch Baruda's remark about withholding some of the data? Is there any missing data?" "Only from very early on," she replied. "Only from the first few weeks, I guess. There were a few holes in the Chinese coverage a little after that. There's still a small amount of data that hasn't been exchanged on all sides. But I don't see any signs of Sirius holding back. Anyway, we'll pick up any missing data swatches after the message recycles."
"If the message recycles," Drumlin growled.
Drahir moderated a discussion on contingency planning, what to do when the primer was received, which American, German, and Japanese industries to notify early about possible major development projects, how to identify key scientists and engineers for constructing the machine, if the decision was made to go ahead, and, briefly, the need to build enthusiasm for the project in Congress and with the American public. Drahir hastened to add that these would be contingency plans only, that no final decision was being made, and that no doubt Soviet concerns about a Trojan horse were at least partly genuine. Kitz asked about the composition of the crew. "They're asking us to put people in 5 upholstered chairs." "Which people? How do we decide? It'll probably have to be an international crew. How many Americans? How many Russians? Anybody else? We don't know what happens to those 5 people when they sit down in those chairs, but we want to have the best men for the job."
Ellie did not rise to the bait, and he continued.
"Now a major question is going to be who pays for what? Who builds what? Who's in charge of overall systems integration? I think we can do some real horse trading on this, in exchange for significant American representation in the crew."
But we still want to send the best possible people," Drahir noted, a little obviously.
"Sure," returned Kitz. "But what do we mean by best? Scientists? People with military intelligence backgrounds? Physical strength and endurance? Patriotism? That's not a dirty word, you know. And then..."
He looked up from buttering another croissant to glance directly at Ellie.
"There's the question of sex. Sexes, I mean. Do we send only men? If it's men and women, there has to be more of one sex than the other. There's 5 places, an odd number. Are all the crew members going to work together okay? If we go ahead with this project, there's going to be a lot of tough negotiation."
"This doesn't sound right to me," said Ellie. "This isn't some ambassadorship you buy with a campaign contribution. This is serious business. Also, do you want some muscle-bound moron up there? Some kid in his 20s who knows nothing about how the world works? Just how to run a respectable 100-yard dash and how to obey orders? Or some political hack? That can't be what this trip is about."
"No, you're right," Kit smiled.
"I think we'll find people who satisfy all our criteria."
Drahir, the bags under his eyes making him look almost haggard, adjourned the meeting. He managed to give Ellie a small private smile, but it was all lips, no teeth. The embassy limousines were waiting to take them back to the Elysee Palace.
"I'll tell you why it would be better to send Russians," Vege was saying. "When you Americans were opening up your country, pioneers, trappers, Indian scouts, all that, you were unopposed, at least by anyone at your level of technology. You raced across your continent from the Atlantic to the Pacific. After a while, you expected everything would be easy. Our situation was different. We were conquered by the Mongols. Their horse technology was much superior to ours. When we expanded eastward, we were careful. We never crossed the wilderness and expected it would be easy. We're more adjusted to adversity than you are. Also, Americans are used to being ahead technologically. We're used to catching up technologically. Now everybody on Earth is a Russian. You understand? I mean, in our historical position. This mission needs Soviets more than it needs Americans."
Merely meeting with her alone entailed certain risks for Vege, and for her as well, as Kitz had gone out of his way to remind her. Sometimes, during a scientific meeting in America or Europe, Vege would be permitted to spend an afternoon with her.
More often, he was accompanied by colleagues or a KGB babysitter, who would be described as a translator, even when his English was clearly inferior to Vege's, or as a scientist from the secretariat of this or that academy commission, except that his knowledge of the scientific matters often proved superficial. Vege would shake his head when asked about them. But by and large, he considered the babysitters a part of the game, the price you must pay when they let you visit the West. And more than once she thought she detected a note of affection in Vege's voice when he talked to the babysitter. To go to a foreign country and pretend to be expert in a subject you know poorly must be filled with anxiety. Perhaps in their heart of hearts, the babysitters detested their assignment as much as Vege did. They were seated at the same window table at Chez Dieu. A distinct chill was in the air, a premonition of winter, and a young man wearing a long blue scarf as his only concession to the cold strode briskly past the tubs of chilled oysters outside the window. From Lunacharsky's continuing and uncharacteristically guarded remarks, she deduced disarray in the Soviet delegation. The Soviets were concerned that the machine might somehow redound to the strategic advantage of the United States in the five-decade-old global competition. Vege had, in fact, been shocked by Baruda's question about burning the data and destroying the radio telescopes. He had had no advanced knowledge of Baruda's position.
The Soviets had played a vital role in gathering the message with the largest longitudinal coverage of any nation,
Vege stressed, and they had the only serious ocean-going radio telescopes. They would expect a major role in whatever came next. Ellie assured him that as far as she was concerned, they should have such a role. Look, Vege, they know from our television transmissions that the Earth rotates, and that there are many different nations. The Olympic broadcast alone might have told them that. Subsequent transmissions from other nations would have nailed it down. So if they're as good as we think, they could have phased the transmission with the Earth's rotation, so only one nation got the message. They chose not to do that. They want the message to be received by everybody on the planet. They're expecting the machine to be built by the whole planet. This can't be an all-American or an all-Russian project. It's not what our client wants. But she was not sure, she told him, that she would be playing any role in decisions on machine construction or crew selection. She was returning to the United States the next day, mainly to get on top of the new radio data from the past few weeks. The consortium plenary sessions seemed interminable, and no closing date had been set. Vege had been asked by his people to stay on at least a little longer. The foreign minister had just arrived and was now leading the Soviet delegation.
"I'm worried all this will end badly," he said. "There are so many things that can go wrong. Technological failures, political failures, human failures. And even if we get through all that, if we don't have a war because of the machine, if we build it correctly and without blowing ourselves up, I'm still worried."
"About what? How do you mean?"
"The best that can happen is we will be made fools of."
"Who will?"
"Arroway, don't you understand?"
A vein in Lunacharsky's neck throbbed.
"I'm amazed you don't see it. The Earth is a ghetto. Yes, a ghetto. All human beings are trapped here. We have heard vaguely that there are big cities out there beyond the ghetto, with broad boulevards filled with droskies and beautiful perfumed women in furs. But the cities are too far away, and we are too poor ever to go there, even the richest of us. Anyway, we know they don't want us. That's why they've left us in this pathetic little village in the first place. And now along comes an invitation. As she said, fancy. Elegant. They have sent us an engraved card and an empty droshky. We are to send 5 villagers, and the droshky will carry them to, who knows, Warsaw or Moscow? Maybe even Paris? Of course, some are tempted to go. There will always be people who are flattered by the invitation or who think it is a way to escape our shabby village. And what do you think will happen when we get there? Do you think the Grand Duke will have us to dinner? Will the president of the Academy ask us interesting questions about daily life in our filthy shtetl? Do you imagine the Russian Orthodox Metropolitan will engage us in learned discourse on comparative religion? No, Arroway.
We will gawk at the big city, and they will laugh at us behind their hands. They will exhibit us to the curious. The more backward we are, the better they'll feel, the more reassured they'll be. It's a quota system. Every few centuries, five of us get to spend a weekend on Vega. Have pity on the provincials, and make sure they know who their betters are.